Welcome to this installment of Witness to Yesterday, the podcast of the Champlain Society. My name is Nicole O'Byrne, and I'm a legal historian at the Faculty of Law, University of New Brunswick, which is located on the unceded and unsurrendered land of the Wolastoqiyik. Today, I'll be interviewing Bill Wazer and Jenny Hansen about their book, Cheated, The Laurier Liberals and the Theft of First Nations Reserve Land, published by ECW Press in 2023. Historian Bill Wazer is the author of 21 books, including Saskatchewan, A New History, and All Hell Can't Stop Us, The On to Ottawa Trek and Regina Riot. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, a member of the Order of Saskatchewan and the Order of Canada, and he is a two-time winner of the Governor General's Award. He has won numerous research and teaching awards, and as a former student of his at the University of Saskatchewan, I can attest to the fact that his passion for prairie history is inspirational, and it might be contagious because that's what I ended up doing my master's and my PhD about. Jenny Hansen, his co-author, is a historian who specializes in how nature was understood, appropriated, and administered under British imperialism. She earned her PhD in history at the University of Saskatchewan under Bill's supervision and has extensive training in archives and records management. Bill and Jenny, thank you so much for joining us on Witness to Yesterday.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
In the epilogue, you mentioned that this project began with the search for the 1913 Ferguson Inquiry Report. Could you tell us how this archival search turned into a co-authored book?
Sure. So for a few years, we were both involved in specific claims research. At one point, we were asked to find any and all information about a commission led by Thomas Roberts Ferguson in 1913 about the alienation of Crown lands under the Laurier Liberals. The commission files and reports were lost or discarded during the years of the Union government, but there was sufficient news coverage that we were able to pick up on the commission's path and look further into the surrenders ourselves. That experience convinced us that there was need for a general study of First Nations reserve surrenders under the Wilfrid Laurier Liberal government, which was 1896 to 1911.
What's interesting about the Ferguson study was a payback study. It was introduced by the new Borden Conservative government to get back at the Liberals. The Liberals had been in power from 1896 to 1911. The Conservatives believed that there was a lot of under-the-table dealings under the Laurier Liberals. And Robert Rogers, a prime figure in the Borden government, wanted to have a commission that would more or less tar the Liberals with all of this scandal and wrongdoing. What Jenny and I discovered is that it's really a political inquiry. It does mention reserve surrenders in some areas, but it's more or less payback. But it offered a hint of what was going on, and that was the spark that encouraged Jenny and I to pursue it in greater detail.
Even though the report of the Ferguson Commission was lost, it's clear that the findings pointed to serious wrongdoing by various government officials working for the Department of the Interior. This is a really complex story. Could you take us through the general findings?
Well, there was more than two dozen surrenders aggressively pursued by the Laurier government over a 15-year period. One in 5 acres was taken from Prairie First Nations. The Laurier government justified this confiscation on the grounds that the bands had too much reserve land and it would be better used by white settlers. The surrendered land was largely scooped up by well-connected Liberal speculators and then flipped for a tidy profit. That included 3 senior civil servants and a Liberal cabinet minister who shamelessly used their position to secure surrendered lands. Despite the findings of the Ferguson Commission being aired in the House of Commons in 1916, none of those 3 was ever held to account for their fraudulent gains.
The book introduces us to many colorful characters, such as Clifford Sifton and Frank Oliver. Could you tell us a bit about their approach to homestead policy and reserve lands?
So we say that this is a story about insiders in Ottawa. It's about politics, power, patronage, and profit. The Department of the Interior and the Department of the Indian Affairs, the DIA, were operated under a two-hat system at the time. And what that means is that the same cabinet minister led both departments. So when Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier appointed Clifford Sifton to the cabinet, he had a great deal of power in the Canadian West because the Interior ran the Federal Immigration and Settlement Program and Indian Affairs oversaw the Treaty and Reserve System. Sifton, at the time, was expected to reduce DIA spending by capping assistance, slashing staff, and streamlining the administration. What he actually did, though, he appointed some unscrupulous colleagues to be staff and suppliers for the government. And this network willingly used their positions to benefit themselves and others in the Liberal Party. In other words, they were cheating. Our book focuses on one aspect of the network, and that is those individuals that use certain clauses in the Indian Act to alienate Treaty Reserve land from Canada's First Nations people. By 1913, just under 2,723,000 acres had been set aside as treaty reserves. So that's one half of 1% of the total acreage of the Prairie Provinces. And under the Sifton, and even more so under his successor, Frank Oliver, the Department of Indian Affairs became like a machine for expropriation. Men with special qualifications were recruited to obtain surrenders at any cost.
And I think what Jenny says there, a machine for expropriation, is key. The way to think of the Liberals assuming power in 1896, and it's something that Jenny and I both noticed in the correspondence and in the speeches to Liberal rallies, the message was, it's our turn. We've been in opposition since 1876. We've watched the McDonald Conservatives benefit from patronage, et cetera, et cetera. So when the Laurier Liberals take over, Sifton is not only that double minister, Minister of Interior, Minister of Indian Affairs, but he's in charge of patronage in Western Canada. And the attitude with regard to the two departments is that Interior takes priority. Our Laurier Liberals want to settle the West, complete that last great task of Confederation. Indian Affairs is an afterthought. In fact, the attitude is that First Nations have had their chance and they have failed as farmers. And they've got too much land. They're not making good use of it. It could be used for better purposes. So as Jenny said, they see an opportunity here. And they push that opportunity because of those double hats, Interior and Indian Affairs, to push land surrenders. And it starts off slowly, almost by accident, because there are two or three reserves in Western Canada that have never been occupied or abandoned. The Liberals take over those reserves. They transfer that reserve land back to the Interior, but they see it as an opportunity that they can expand this this reserve surrender business, and they go at it with great alacrity for personal benefit. And that's the key, as Jenny said, it's about profit and patronage. That's what's going on here.
Well, there's certainly a lot of strange and fraudulent dealings happening. So let's get into the more particulars. By what means did officials in the Department of Indian Affairs actually compel First Nations to surrender their reserve land? What did that look like?
Well, when the Indian Act is introduced in 1876, there's a debate in the House of Commons, I think it's second reading in March of 1876. And one of the provisions of the Indian Act is reserve surrenders. In fact, while the treaties are still being negotiated, Treaty 6 is being negotiated August, September 1876, and Treaty 7 the following year. Before those treaties have even been negotiated, they're talking about reserve surrenders in the Indian Act several months before. And during that debate, there is some confusion. Under the provisions of the Indian Act, the majority male members of a band are the ones who are called upon to vote upon a possible surrender. And Sir Hector Langevin, who formerly held that position as a superintendent of Indian Affairs, asked, well, do you mean the majority of male members at the meeting or the majority of male members of the band? Because that's an important distinction. And Prime Minister Mackenzie says at the time, it's majority male members of the band. That's not how Indian Affairs moves forward under the Laurier Liberals. What happens under the Laurier Liberals is that it's only the male members at the meeting. And who you're talking about, only a handful of people can make that decision on a reserve surrender. What the Indian Act provisions also call upon is for a detailed account of that meeting. Many of those surrenders are not documented in any way, including the vote. That vote has to be certified, and sometimes that's very loosey-goosey. And so, in other words, they push the bounds of the provisions of the Indian Act, and they don't necessarily follow them, but they massage them a bit, and so they're doing a number of things to get away with it, plus using intimidation. At surrender meetings, they'll call repeated meetings. If they don't get the result they like the first vote call, they'll call repeated votes. They'll wait for some members of the band that are resistant to surrenders to be away, then call the vote. They even showed up with suitcases full of cash. And during the discussions to take a reserve surrender, the person in charge of the reserve surrender, the Indian Affairs representative, would put cash on the table, meaning, if you take or accept the surrender today, I can start dispensing cash to you immediately. So it's all kinds of practices they engaged in.
Many First Nations resisted the surrender of their reserve lands. Could you tell us about some of these stories? And I'm particularly interested in learning more about the Treaty 4 delegation who went to Ottawa in 1911.
What I want to make clear that Jenny and I do and cheated, and it's something she said earlier in our interview, is that we look at the story from inside. We look at it from the Ottawa perspective. We know there is a First Nations voice, but that's not the purpose of this book. We want to talk about the inner machinations of Indian Affairs and what they did to secure these reserve surrenders. Yes, there was some First Nations pushback, but in many cases, they're bulldozed by Indian Affairs officials. But as you say, Nicole, in 1911, Treaty 4 First Nations, the various bands come together, and they're very dissatisfied with Indian Affairs policy under the Laurier Liberals. The failure to honor treaty promises, reserve surrenders, farming policy, et cetera, et cetera. So they gather together, they raise enough funds amongst themselves to send a group of delegates to Ottawa to meet not only with Frank Oliver, the Indian Affairs Minister, but the Deputy Minister, Frank Pedley. So this is a very significant event in First Nations history in the sense that you have a Treaty 4 delegation going to Ottawa, meeting this mysterious person called government, and dealing with the two senior Indian Affairs officials in the country. The meeting lasts 5 days, and what's significant is that Osoup from Treaty 4 is there. He was at the Treaty 4 negotiations. He was a participant, and he knew what was promised at the time, and he raises that during the meetings in Ottawa in 1911. They also talk about reserve surrenders. Where is the money from the reserve surrenders? And it's during that meeting that Oliver is very patronizing, and it's where the title for the book comes from. At one point, he says to the Treaty 4 delegates, "You are not being cheated." How does Indian Affairs regard this delegation? They're a bunch of troublemakers. That's the standard Indian Affairs response to any First Nations leader who complains about Indian policy. They are troublemakers. And they don't intend to do anything or change anything after the delegation leaves.
So much of the land dispossession was done legally through amendments to the Federal Indian Act. Could you explain how the law was used to serve the interest of land speculators?
I think both law and policy was manipulated to serve the interest of land speculators and to facilitate the surrenders. Bill, you can address a little bit more about how the payment schedules, for example, were used and manipulated after the surrenders were made.
First of all, they started off with closed tenders. And so once a reserve land was surrendered, it was made available through closed tender sales. And you had to bid on every quarter section. So there might have been thousands of acres surrendered by a reserve, or in the case of Moose Mountain, two reserves. I think Jenny's at 40 square miles?
Something like that.
It's around that, something like that. 40 square miles of land is surrendered. And they, in the early 20th century, they put that land up for sale. But you have to bid on it by private tender, by quarter section. So every quarter section, you have to submit a separate bid. They do that for a number of years, and then they find that it's not as successful as it once was. And then they go to open auction. And at open auction, you initially had to put 10% down of the amount you bid for the land, 10% down for that quarter section. But Indian Affairs officials said that, well, that's not really helping buyers. It's not really helping speculators. So they reduced the amount that you've had to put down to 5%. So what happens is that these speculators are buying large swaths of former reserve land at 5% down, and then they have to meet annual installments. Well, in many instances, they didn't. Land that was sold in the early 20th century was still being paid off in the 1920s and 1930s.
Or not paid at all, and that didn't necessarily mean that it reverted back to the band. In fact, it never did.
Yeah. So we've seen files that are part of the Indian Affairs collection that are several inches thick pertaining to reserve surrenders and sales. And it's shocking and it's disappointing. And that's the other thing that should be emphasized is that Jenny and I used Indian Affairs extensively. And if there was any group in Canadian history that was so well documented, particularly from a statistical point of view, it was First Nations. The records are meticulous. And what Jenny and I were able to do is Indian Affairs officials self-incriminated themselves. It's all documented. It's all there.
Fascinating. Now, while much of the land was surrendered by quote-unquote legal means through various processes stipulated in the Indian Act, it's clear that much of the land was acquired by illegal tendering processes, which you've described, and other fraudulent means. Could you describe one of these specific crooked deals? Who benefited, and did anyone ever face any serious consequences?
So in our book, we tell the story of a trio of government insiders that speculated in Assiniboine lands at Moose Mountain. In this scheme, DSGIA, the Deputy Superintendent General of Indian Affairs, James Smart, used his influence to press for surrenders of the Pheasants, Rump, and Ocean Man reserves. Frank Pedley, a superintendent in immigration at the time, he later became DSGIA, but at the time he was superintendent of immigration, and he created a cover with his former legal partner, A.C. Bedford Jones, to purchase most of the land below market price. They obtained direct control of the lands and conducted negotiations with buyers from Minnesota, and that portion of it bought 45,000 acres for more than double the tender amount. Those buyers were located through William White's cross-border connections. William White ran the immigration agencies for Canada and the Northern United States. The Ferguson Commission revealed that Pedley earned the top-tier salary during his long tenure as Deputy Minister of Indian Affairs, and that he and his conspirators had pocketed cash windfalls from the sale of those reserve lands. It amounted to the equivalent of $1.9 million in today's currency, just from the Moose Mountain transaction, and there were other ones. They were able to do this, not simply because of their positions, but because the interests and well-being of two First Nation bands were not being protected by the Department of Indian Affairs. The details of Pedley's complicity in obtaining reserve surrenders from First Nation peoples and his trafficking in some of those surrendered land, those all came to light in the Ferguson Commission in 1913. Pedley saved himself from the embarrassment of dismissal by resigning his government position on October 11th of that year. After leaving the public service, Frank and his wife Helen went to Europe and stayed abroad until the summer of 1914, and they only returned to Canada when rumors of war couldn't be ignored any longer. But there were no financial repercussions for Pedley or the other two. James Smart created a for-profit immigration agency based in Montreal and developed a large estate on the island there that he rarely left, and White retired to Lockwood, Saskatchewan, where he and his wife had a farm operation that they operated with two of their adult children. And that's how that story ended.
Yeah, and it really is galling, Nicole. And I find what's particularly galling about it is that, as Jenny says, they use their positions. What James Smart did is he asked for the surveyor's valuations of the land that was going up for sale. And then they use these surveyor valuations to determine their tender bid. So they knew what the land was valued at. And so they would craft their tender bid to match this valuation. And in crafting that tender bid, they used the typewriter in Pedley's Ottawa office. They used Ottawa stationery, official government stationery, to submit these tender bids. That's how galling it is. The other surrender that's worth mentioning and the benefit that would come to an individual was Frank Oliver, the MP for Edmonton. Frank Oliver entered House of Commons in 1896 as what he called himself an independent liberal, but he quickly became a Laurier liberal in 1905, who replaces Clifford Sifton. Frank Oliver believed that there should not be a reserve near any Western city, particularly Edmonton. In fact, that was his constant refrain. We need to get rid of reserves around Edmonton. So when Oliver is Minister of Interior, what's not widely known is that there was a reserve outside Edmonton, the Michael Reserve. Part of that land was surrendered. Two major speculators bought the majority of that reserve land. These two major speculators failed to make their installment bids. And around 1910, 1911, a lifeline was thrown to one of the speculators who couldn't meet his bids. It was an Edmonton banker. He offered to buy the land that this speculator had bought in the Michael Reserve, and he helped that speculator out by buying this land. It turns out that this banker who helped the speculator who couldn't meet his installments was Frank Oliver's son-in-law. This banker was married to Frank Oliver's daughter. And this banker then quietly transferred this land he had purchased from the speculator to Frank Oliver. So you have a minister of the crown who represents Indian affairs securing surrendered reserve land. This is brought to the attention of the House of Commons. Frank Oliver might have been embarrassed by it, but he's never held to account. None of them are held to account, as Jenny said. They all get away with it.
Well, the book contains many shocking stories of land theft from First Nations. There clearly was a short-term gain for the individuals involved, such as Frank Oliver, at the time, but who ultimately benefited from these schemes? And then a follow-up question would be, it might be a little unfair to ask historians to predict the future, but what do you think will happen now that the evidence of wrongdoing has been brought to light?
Well, first of all, let's go back to Ferguson. They're able to get away with it. The Ferguson Report is introduced in House of Commons and debated at length. It covers, the debate cause covers 50 pages of answer. And Borden is looking for an election issue in 1915. He's been in power for 4 years. He wants to go to the polls. And they actually believe that the Ferguson Report is a way that they can leverage an election and hit the Liberals over the head. That's in early 1915. What happens April 22nd, 1915? Second Battle of Ypres. Four-day battle, 2,000 Canadians killed, wounded, or taken captured. And so the whole focus of House of Commons shifts to the war overseas, and that the Canadians are bloodied. It becomes our Great War as well. And so the Conservatives backtrack from holding an election. The Conservatives thereafter find that they have to bring forward a union government. And if you're going to bring forward a union government, you do not want to have a kind of document that would smear your coalition partner, the Ferguson Report. And as Jenny said at the beginning of the interview, it quietly disappears. We don't think it's destroyed. It's often said it was destroyed in the February 1916 parliamentary fire. But we've seen references to ministers of the crown referring to the Ferguson Report thereafter. We both believed it was quietly deep-sixed for political reasons. Your second question, one of the longer terms, how do you predict the future? Jenny and I are both involved in specific claims, right, Jenny?
Yes.
And we've seen this process go on for decades. Decades. It takes a long time once a specific claim is submitted. The reports are prepared, the hearings, the expert testimony, decision. We would just recommend or suggest that this process should be accelerated because it's been over 100 years. And the other thing that should be noted from the study is that a lot of people are talking about residential school experience and First Nations. We argue in Cheetah that this is just as important. Reserves were homes to First Nations. Even though in the beginning of the 1870s, they were reluctant to take up the reserves, in the latter half of the 19th century, reserves became First Nations homes. It's the place where they could practice, you know, they got together with family, they practiced their cultural beliefs, it's where their dead was. The reserves were home to them, and yet these reserves are being taken away. And so we argue that this reserve surrender process is just as important to the Indigenous, non-Indigenous story today as residential schools, and more Canadians need to know about it.
Well, you certainly make a good case for the importance of these issues in this book. I couldn't put it down. I wish you good luck on the specific claims. There's a lot more work there because the Department of Indian Affairs kept such good comprehensive records, right? So at the end of your book, you mentioned this is just kind of the start of things. So we encourage our listeners and people looking for any further research projects to go check out some of those records, and you've led kind of the path to that kind of future research. And for that, I really commend you. This work is a really spectacular achievement and shows what historians can do when they know their way around an archive.
Thank you. And we should also thank ECW Press. Jenny will tell you about our experience with them.
Oh, they've been great. ECW Press was, when we submitted the manuscripts, they got back to us within 48 hours and we had a contract on the go, and they've just been equally supportive through the entire process. And it was out within a year, and the editors and the publisher has just been, and they've been responding to us and providing feedback all the way through. Even the proofreaders sent like an essay of response back, just because the reactions to this book are visceral. People are really interested in it, and it's making its way into the general public, which is what we hoped all along.
Yeah, and your reaction at the beginning is quite common.
Mm-hmm.
I get calls out of the blue from people that, first of all, vent. They are so angry about what happened, and they didn't know, and also people genuinely thankful. And it's not just the non-Indigenous community. When Jenny and I have held book launch sessions, et cetera, we've had First Nations people out. We've had chiefs, former chiefs, band counselors, economic officers. In fact, Jenny had an experience with somebody from Moose Mountain recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he contacted me and he just wanted to talk more about what was known about that period and that time and how to access the files. And it was a great conversation.
So we see this as a reconciliation story too.
Well, it certainly is that. Thank you so much. My guests today have been Bill Wazer and Jenny Hansen. They are the co-authors of Cheated, The Laurier Liberals and the Theft of First Nations Reserve Land, published by ECW Press in 2023. You've been listening to Witness to Yesterday. Please visit the Champlain Society's website where you can learn more about the Champlain Society's work. If you have enjoyed listening to this podcast, then please share our information on social media. This podcast was made possible by the members of the Champlain Society who work hard to bring to life original documents of Canadian history. We would like to thank the L.R. Wilson Institute of History at McMaster University, as well as a consortium of Canadian scholarly book publishers that includes the University of Toronto Press, UBC Press, McGill Queen's University Press, the University of Regina Press, and the University of Ottawa Press. My name is Nicole O'Byrne. This interview was recorded on February 20th, 2024. It was produced by Jessica Schmidt and supported by the University of Toronto Press Journal team.